In a few days' time, resident doctors, who used to be known as junior doctors, were meant to be going on strike. The ostensible reason was pay. But now the dispute may be over without any more increases to salary levels. The government has instead made an offer to do something about the other big issue for early career doctors, working conditions and specialist training places. This issue is critical not just for the doctors, but for the running of the NHS itself. So what's going on and what's the problem with the way we in Britain have been training our doctors? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, I'm joined by the BBC's health editor, Hugh Pym, to give us some background on the doctors' dispute. Hugh, we were expecting a doctor's strike in a few days' time. Tell us what's actually happened.
Well, a lot has happened very close to the strike actually taking place. On Wednesday evening, Wes Streeting appeared in the Commons and announced a new offer, which hadn't been expected. It appears that the back channels between the government and the BMA had been working away, even though the rhetoric had been really quite fierce on both sides. And there was a bit of an expectation that the five-day strike in England, due to start on December the 17th, would take place. So he's made a new offer to the British Medical Association. And what's significant is they've said they will at least put it to members, which hadn't happened before, going back to the strikes in July and November. And the way they're going to put it is through an online survey. And based on that survey, they'll decide whether or not the strike goes ahead.
Right, so they haven't got much time to do it. Hugh, what I found interesting, particularly for the purposes of this programme, about this discussion between the BMA and Wes Streeting, is that some of it was about pay, of course, but a lot of it was about something else. It was about working conditions and jobs, and particularly this thing they call training places. Can you take me through what the problem is that they think they have?
Well, when you finished your medical studies and you qualify as a doctor, you then do two foundation years when you get very important clinical experience. At that point, you have to apply for a training place. And that is, well, you don't have to, but the expectation is you might well want to. And what training means is that you go into a specialist area and you do several years of working, say, as an anaesthetist, or an emergency department doctor, or a surgeon.
Or a GP,
although that's a slightly different scheme. But you're training in that specialist area. And that is very important if you want to progress your career and get to a level of becoming a consultant. Now, the problem has been that there are people who are in their second foundation year applying for these posts, and some of them have really struggled to find anything. Some of them have become unemployed for a bit. Some end up taking locum jobs, and they feel very frustrated that there aren't enough places for them in the system to progress their careers.
So we are talking about, if you like, a bottleneck. We've got these doctors coming up, and then the career path narrows suddenly.
That's absolutely right. Now, there are various reasons for that. It's partly long-term workforce planning. You have to look quite a long way ahead when you're planning future doctor training to work out what might be needed. And it's turned out that more have come on stream in some senses than what the government expected and what it was expected they'd have to pay in terms of doctor numbers going through training places. But you've also got another factor, the visa issue. In 2019, visas became a lot easier to obtain for overseas doctors to come and work in the UK, and they've been applying for training places. So you get to a point when you had 30,000 applicants for 10,000 places, and that has resulted in some, maybe quite a few UK-trained doctors missing out and feeling very frustrated. And that's one aspect of the offer which Wes Streeting has come up with.
So what's Wes Streeting offering? How many training places are there and how many is he offering to increase it to?
Well, in the latest year, there are about 10,000 training places. In the 10-year plan published in the summer for the NHS in England, it was assumed another 1,000 would be added on over 3 years. He raised that offer to 2,000 extra places in November, but that was rejected by the BMA. They said it wasn't enough. His latest offer is for 4,000 training places, again over 3 years. And importantly, he says he will try and push through legislation through Parliament, which will enable NHS employers to give priority to UK medical students coming through the system and their foundation years. And of course, up until that point, an employer can't discriminate on the basis of nationality. And that's one of the things that West Streeting feels needs to be cleared up.
Now, my mathematics is not brilliant, but 4,000 on top of 10,000 is an increase of 40%. So it's a pretty big increase in the number.
Yes, I mean, it'll increase gradually up to that point over 3 years. And what West Streeting says is a combination of these policies will result, instead of, say, four applicants for one place, it'll come down to two applicants for one place. Now, the detail of that calculation we haven't really totally looked into, but the theory is that you'll have UK medical trained students getting priority, and you've got more training places, and it'll result in this problem being cleared up. But clearly, you know, that's based on a prediction rather than us being totally sure.
And did the BMA have a number in their minds about what they wanted? Did they have a demand about training places, or were they just saying more?
They were just saying more. And their argument is, look, it's taken a strike in November and the threat of another one now to actually get West Streeting to increase to 2,000, then 4,000.
Now, Hugh, isn't there an extra complexity about this, and forgive me if I've misunderstood, which is the pay applies to England, but the training places applies to the whole of Britain?
That's right. The training places is a UK-wide responsibility for medical schools, and the Department of Health would have that power to do it. But the pay, yes, is very much down to each devolved administration and Westminster for England.
So, Hugh, what happens next?
So one of the issues not covered in this is pay, the headline rate. The BMA's demand is for higher salaries. And just a reminder, West Streeting's argument is I've increased their pay by nearly 29% over 3 years, far more than other public sector unions. There is no more money for pay, but I will help out with a few costs, financial issues like paying for exam fees and that sort of thing. So the question is to what extent resident doctors feel that pay is their main motivation and therefore this dispute may well continue, or to what extent are the resident doctors most affected by the training places, the more junior of the resident doctors, is their feeling that this might be a decent offer and that this dispute can be ended.
Hugh Pym. Let's focus now on the resident doctors, who they are and how they're trained. Sir Andrew Goddard is a consultant gastroenterologist in Derby and past president of the Royal College of Physicians. Andrew Goddard, let's talk about the beginning of this process. See, medicine has always been very competitive to get into, I've been told that. What are the figures for applicants versus the number of places that we have at the moment?
Medical school remains competitive to get into. There are in the UK about 11,000 medical school places, and those are traditional undergraduate courses, which are 5 years long. And there are some graduate entry medical school places, which people have done a degree first for 3 years, and then they go and do a four-year course. And so the competition for those places depends on the medical school. Some medical schools are much more competitive than others, particularly in London and in Oxbridge, for example. Overall, if you apply to medical school, you probably have about a 3 to 4 in 1 chance of getting in.
So there are roughly 3 to 4 times as many applicants as there are places.
Yeah. And it varies year to year on average. But again, it depends where you apply.
Do we have enough doctors?
We don't have enough doctors, and that's the problem. And we've tried to overcome that as a country by pinching from elsewhere in the world, which doesn't really make sense. We should, and hopefully increasing the number of medical student numbers will do this. We can start to become self-sufficient. But we've always been really reliant on doctors from other parts of the world to support our workforce. And if you take consultants, which I know most about, there was some recent data in October which showed in some hospitals 30% of consultant posts were vacant. Now, that's only a small number of hospitals, but there are vacancies everywhere. And I know that with my own hospital, we have vacant posts that we cannot appoint to. And we go out to adverts often, and there aren't the people to fill those places. And the same is true for general practice. So there is an overall shortage of doctors.
Can we just go through now how doctors are actually trained today? Because this is quite complicated. You get into university or medical school. Take us through how long you have to spend there, and then what happens to doctors, how they would anticipate their careers or their training to progress.
Most people spend 5 years in medical school. Those that have done a degree first and going into a graduate entry medical school will do 4 years, but they've all done 3 years. So they're sort of 7 years in education already. And then once you qualify and you can put doctor in front of your name, you then hopefully get a place on the foundation program. Now, the foundation program is a 2-year scheme that was set up following concerns about training about 20 years ago. You spend 2 years basically learning your trade, but not specializing. So you'll rotate between different posts in hospitals and within primary care and some community settings, including psychiatry. At that point, you then have to make a decision what you want to do with your medical life. And some people say, I want to go straight into training and train to become, like me, a gastroenterologist in hospital, or train to be a GP, or train to be a pediatrician, or train to be a surgeon, or whatever. Other people say, I'm not really sure I know what I want to do, but I want to stay in the UK in the NHS, and they'll do other posts within hospitals, which are not formal training posts, but they are getting lots of experience. The term that we currently use is a locally employed doctor. Other people say, no, don't really, medicine's not for me, I'm going to go and do something else. And some people say, yeah, medicine's for me, but not in this country. And I want a bit of time to travel. I've not had a chance to travel whilst I've been a student or in the foundation program. I'll go abroad.
Now, let's talk about how people are then distributed across the UK. So how do we decide where these trainee doctors go in the first instance?
So the first decision point is when you come out of medical school and you enter a foundation program. So every region where there are medical schools within England, and I'll talk about England, but it includes Scotland because the foundation program is UK-wide, they apply to a foundation school. And that used to be, and it is being changed, used to be, over the past couple of years, a very contentious process whereby a student would rank which foundation school they wanted to work in. And then a computer would be used to generate a random list of all of those students. And then the computer would go through whoever was the lucky ticket holder at number one, they would get their first choice of medical school. And they would go down and everybody would get their first choice of medical school until that medical school was full. And then they would go down until there was nobody left who hadn't got a place in their first choice or there were places. So it's quite complicated. But it, because the previous system meant that only 71 to 75% of people were getting first choice foundation school placements, they came up with this system. It worked insofar as that 84% of people, so big increase, were getting their first choice of foundation school. So they were staying for their foundation jobs where they wanted to go. But it did mean that other people might be randomized to somewhere completely far from where they wanted. And you hear stories of people in London being given a job in Belfast or wherever. So it's worked on one level, as it means more people have got what they want. But actually, there are a group of people who've ended up being really, the system has not worked for them, if I can put it that way.
Can I be patient's devil's advocate for a moment
here?
Why wouldn't I want the people with the greatest merit to go to some of the places where people least wanted to go?
I think that's a very fair point. And there has been a lot of debate about getting the best people to go to places where they need really good people. But there's a double-edged sword to this so far, is that if you disenfranchise people and you don't reward hard work and excellence, people might say, why should I bother? And it makes the career choice far less attractive, and it's less likely that we'll get really good people. But there has been a lot of talk within foundation trainees. If you have foundation training in year one in the place where you want to be, and the really outstanding people get shared around, so that that improves the standard throughout. But one of the problems is that it's difficult to recruit to places. Often the training experience is poor. If you haven't got lots of consultants around, because you've got lots of vacancies, it's hard to create and free up time for people to train.
Thanks, Andrew, and please stay with us. And before we go on, a quick reminder about the Briefing Room podcast. If you visit BBC Sounds, you can find the entire back catalogue, such as the one which looks at whether there's economic injustice between the older and younger generations, and the one that asks why the UK has such a problem with productivity. OK, time to explore further what the problem is with how we train doctors and what we might do about it. Joining Andrew Goddard and me are Martin McKee, Professor of European Public Health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and also a past president of the BMA, the Doctors' Union, and Mark Diane, a policy analyst at the health think tank, the Nuffield Trust. And I should add that this discussion was recorded a few hours before the government put a new offer on the table. Mark, we heard earlier about the bottleneck when resident doctors apply for specialist training posts and can't get them. What are the reasons for this bottleneck?
So it's always been the case that not everybody who applies to specialist training gets an offer. Well, what we've seen in recent years is that the proportion of applications that are successful have fallen. And that's got to be seen in the context of a very big increase in those applications. So it's not the case that there are fewer UK-trained or overseas-trained people getting a place. The applications have just gone up very, very steeply. And I think that reflects a few different things. One of them is there have been the beginnings of expanding the university-level medical training to take in more people. So there's somewhat more competition from that. We've also, with the changes to migration, we see far, far more applicants from other countries. And it's really important to say that although the number of applicants has risen by multiple times since 2019, the increase in the number of doctors who did their university-level training in other countries who get on to specialist training in the UK has not been that big. It's gone from a bit below 4,000 to a bit above it. But they apply in quite big numbers. They just often don't get the posts. So that really contributes to the much higher number of applicants per position.
I want to be clear about this. So it's not the case that international candidates are crowding out domestic candidates for specialist places any more than they ever did.
I'd put a bit more nuance on it than that because it has gone up a bit since 2019 and it did go up quite a bit before that, quite a while ago, but that did happen.
Martin, what have you seen happen?
Very much the same. I very much agree with Mark. So there has been a massive increase, about a threefold increase in the number of applicants, but the number of training positions has really not increased at all, I think by 1 or 2%. And this is remarkable given that we have this programme of medical school expansion.
Are some specialisms just more popular than others? And is that difficult to manage? In other words, are people trying to crowd into training places for specialisms that are oversubscribed and not to those that are less popular?
Well, it's both specialisms and places. And so those are both need to be taken into account. There always was this issue, and that's why we in the past did talk about Cinderella specialties. They were the ones that people didn't, that were less popular for a number of reasons. It might be to do with opportunities for private practice. It might be to do with opportunities for career progression. It might be to do with the ability to do academic work at the same time. A whole series of factors that might be taken into
which
account.
Which ones have been the Cinderella areas and which ones have been the sort of really popular one?
So in the past, I hesitate to say this, but I think some of the areas like psychiatry, I think, might have been considered. My own specialty, public health, has been perhaps less popular, but that's come and gone. I mean, changes do take place, so the popularity does fluctuate.
And the more popular ones?
Surgery, obviously, some of the surgical procedures where there is an opportunity for a large amount of private practice, I think, have always been very popular. Interventional radiology is one that didn't really exist, in fact, and now has become very popular.
Now, Andrew, what's happening to people if they don't get a specialist training post?
So they tend to become locally employed doctors and try and get themselves ready to apply the following year. They might look elsewhere. So if they've been trying to get a job in a particular region and that's really competitive, and they look at the competition ratios and people look at these things on a regular basis to see where their chances are the greatest, they may then contemplate applying to somewhere different in the next round. I know doctors who are really good and I'd love to have them as my trainee on a training base, but they just can't get in because the competition's so high. And they then sometimes change what specialty they want to do. And so if somebody can't get into internal medicine training, which is what you need to do in order to become a gastroenterologist or a cardiologist or something like that, they may say, okay, I'll think about general practice. And general practice has always been easier to get into because there's been a big clamour for general practice and it's been a bit less popular. And the other thing is there's been a big expansion of the number of training places in general practice, quite rightly, because we need more GPs. We know that 80% of GP places will get filled fairly easily on the first round of application now. But interestingly, to go back to what's been said earlier, is that half of those places are people that have trained overseas. So again, there is a reluctance on UK trained doctors looking at that, you'd think, to go into general practice. But it's simply, I don't think, because we haven't trained enough yet.
One of the things that I hadn't realised before we started on this conversation was the situation with the locally employed doctors and how many of these locally employed doctors don't set out on a specialist path or don't get onto a specialist path. Doesn't that mean that we've essentially end up with two kind of very different levels of doctor?
On one level, yes, but on another level, no, because these people are working in the same environments, often with the same teams and with the same exposure to contact with trainers. But we don't, and we haven't, recognised that time that they take. And I think that's the one thing that we could change fairly easily, is in order to make these roles not seem wasted time, but seen as training time of reform, is to acknowledge that and recognise that, and then allow people to use that to count towards their overall training. There are some posts that are, I hesitate to use the word abuse, but they will put people into roles which aren't carefully supervised, don't provide a reasonable training experience, and they are just there to provide service. There will need to be, obviously, a lot of curation of posts to ensure that if we came up with that, it was not abused. But that's something we could do very simply, which would, in effect, reduce bottlenecks, but also allow people to have an improved access to different training experiences where they want to be. And we know the one thing that defines where people will work is where they want to work and what specialty they want to do. They're two things, not one thing, sorry, two things. And if we can get that right, give people more flexibility to do that, we'll end up with a much, much happier workforce.
Mark, can you take us through who actually plans where and how many doctors we're going to need?
Decisions on how many training places and how many medical school places there should be are taken by the NHS bodies as we go along, and that to some extent is based on ideas about need and which specialties have too many doctors or too few. For a very long time, there was no national workforce plan for England. We had one in 2023, but it actually really concluded that it wasn't able to plan for individual medical specialties because the data wasn't good enough. And the incoming government now has said that workforce plan was not necessarily very realistic, which I think in some ways is fair enough, although at least it had happened. And we're going to get a new one next year on which the burden of expectation, I think, is very heavy.
Andrew, you raised earlier this question of there being a shortage of consultants. Why do you think that is? Is it simply we don't have enough specialist training, so we can't make enough consultants? But then couldn't we have brought them in from abroad if that was the case? So a bit of a paradox.
Not really, because we know that there's a shortage of doctors across the globe. It's not just a UK problem. But we have a changing society. We're living longer. We are much better at keeping people alive and healthy. We've got lots of new treatments. And so what we're doing in healthcare has become much more complicated. And I've seen the type of patients that I look after, particularly in clinic, but also on the ward, becoming much more complicated because they've got older, they've sort of accrued other medical problems. And so rather than having somebody with just a pneumonia, they also happen to have diabetes. And they also have got ischemic heart disease, and they are, in the medical phrase, multimorbid. And therefore, they're complicated people who tend to spend longer in hospital, but you need more people around to manage them. But that also covers one of the paradoxes that you mentioned earlier, is that we create through our training system a whole bunch of specialists, but probably what we need moving forward are people skilled in managing people with multimorbidity, with multiple medical conditions. We need more generalists, if you like, rather than specialists.
In some ways, that would also take us to the question of GPs. We're always hearing that there aren't enough GPs. Is that also a training issue? Mark?
So historically, for much of the last 15 years, it absolutely was. We were not succeeding essentially in having enough students coming out of their foundation training, choosing to go into general practice. Now that has improved, and it's improved actually partly because of the level of overseas applicants that we've had. And so the problem, I think, now is not so much numbers in the specialty training program to become GPs, but at more senior levels of the profession, people who are willing to be partners for GP practice, we've still got a significant workforce problem.
Martin, one of the other things that's often being said at the moment is about all these young trainee doctors and people in the health service upping and leaving the UK for Australia, New Zealand, and other places. And we've already just heard that there's a shortage of doctors across the globe. Is that what's happening?
There's certainly some of that happening, and the salary, for example, of a doctor in the Republic of Ireland is about three times that in the United Kingdom for a consultant. So clearly that's become a real issue in Northern Ireland, where people can actually stay in their own homes in somewhere like Enniskillen and go to work in Sligo. Another thing that we haven't talked about is the dearth of capital investment in the NHS over many years. And when one talks to resident doctors, their irritation with IT systems that are completely antiquated, and where they maybe are waiting long times to get the system to boot up, and when it does, it doesn't meet their needs, or the amount of time that they waste trying to use or get appointments with scanners, to get an ultrasound machine.
Are you saying that some people will be upping and leaving the British NHS because the computer systems in Australia are better or something like that?
There's no one thing here. But when you see a situation where their pay is better, their working conditions are better, the equipment is better, the relationships are better, the weather is better in some cases, all of these factors play a part. And that's what I hear when I talk to the resident doctors that are leaving. It's no one factor.
Mark, yes. Are we seeing an attrition?
Unfortunately, it looks as though we are. And for doctors in particular, the General Medical Council, which is the body that hands out licences to practice for those who qualify to doctors, they've warned that there have been quite large increases among UK-trained doctors in their 20s, their 30s, their 40s leaving, even in the last year. And I think that has to be seen in that wide context of the pressures on training places, the different ways in which the NHS can be quite a difficult place to be a trainee, and issues with pay.
I think we've come to the point whereby we should now be talking about what it is that we're going to do about it. And firstly, to play the government's advocate for it for a moment, Wes Streeting will be saying, I've been doing a lot about this. The pay's gone up. We're planning to increase the training places. What else can, should government and actually other bodies as well be doing to try and improve, particularly the problem of the bottleneck, Martin?
I think that resident doctors are looking for a sense that somebody actually cares about all of this. They look at many of these organisations that are responsible for the system and feel that they're alienated from it, that nobody is listening to their concerns. I think that would be a very good first step.
Mark Dyan, what do you think?
What we at the Nuffield Trust have been proposing are really targeted measures for doctors in those early years of their careers when we see they're dropping out in increasing numbers. Student loans forgiveness would be a good example of that, that might create some sense if you're in a contract with the NHS and it's giving something back, or payment holidays for student loans.
Andrew, there you are in Derby, surrounded by working doctors and a deep knowledge of those who are training and so on. What do you think could usefully and practically be done to improve the situation?
I agree with the idea of medical school loan forgiveness. I think that is one way forward, but you're going to have to think about how you make that tied to some commitment to the NHS, and that will need a bit of thinking about. Clearly, we need more places, and again, Mr. Streeting did offer that.
That's all we've got time for. My thanks to Andrew Goddard, Martin McKee, Mark Dyan, and Hugh Pym. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey, Cordelia Hemming and Kirsty Knight. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundeli. The sound engineers were Michael Rigard and Gareth Jones. And the editor was Richard Varden. And another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Hi, I'm Katie Razzle. And for BBC Radio 4 from Shadow World, this is Anatomy of a Cancellation.
I'm a symbol of a particular time and a extreme version of cancel culture.
Poet and teacher Kate Clancy wrote a book about her 30-year teaching career, which was initially praised.
It's a wonderful book.
But later, others said it was racist and deeply problematic.
The language in this book is so dehumanising.
Unjustified cancellation? Long overdue reckoning? Subscribe to Shadow World, Anatomy of a Cancellation on BBC Sounds. Hi, I'm Katie Razzle, and for BBC Radio 4 from Shadow World, this is Anatomy of a Cancellation.
I'm a symbol of a particular time and an extreme version of cancel culture.
Poet and teacher Kate Clancy wrote a book about her 30-year teaching career, which was initially praised.
It's a wonderful book.
But later, others said it was racist and deeply problematic.
The language in this book is so dehumanising.
Unjustified cancellation? Long overdue reckoning? Subscribe to Shadow World, Anatomy of a Cancellation on BBC Sounds.